Welcome to the El Arpa podcast, the home for cultural chit-chat in and outside Madrid. People will talk. Welcome to the El Arpa podcast. Thank you for joining us for another episode of this award-winning, well, not yet, podcast. So, Maria, I have a question to ask you. Why is it you have such a problem with articles?
I don't. It's the English language that just does it the wrong way.
It just seems to me this is a Spanish thing where you're just lobbing, throwing ands and as and this, where there's just no place for them.
No, I think Spanish students just like have problems because what you call a generic name or a collective name and so on in Spanish is different from what you do in English.
That's very true, yes.
Yeah, I'm talking about students, not about myself.
Okay. It's funny though, because when this podcast was initially conceived, it was kind of for students and we were... Well, it still is in a way. I think you can practice your English.
Yeah, but people that try to study with these hate us.
Like who? Your sister? Like... Now, the record show, I haven't mentioned her by name, so she cannot be angry.
It can be one of two anyway.
Oh, your brother.
It can be one of two sisters.
Has the other one learned? Has she...
No, she hasn't listened to us.
Oh, yeah. Why not, though?
I don't know.
Because my sisters listen to us and my mother, as we've established in previous episodes.
Yes.
Barry has. He's not even a blood relative.
People don't know who Barry is. You cannot just say like Barry does.
Barry knows who Barry is. But this is
very metaphysical.
No, not metaphysical. But like, obviously when you say people who have tried to listen to it, to study it, have hated it, is obviously a dig at me. It's a reference to me because they can't understand me.
But you said that, not me.
Oh my God, it's very passive-aggressive. Though knowing you would probably say that's very the passive-aggressive. So what I was trying to say is that when this was originally conceived, that it was supposed to be for students and be more student-orientated, but you can still listen to it if you're a student.
Yes.
If you're not related to Maria and you're a student, you probably would like it. If you are related and you're a student, maybe the chances are less. I don't know. So, on to the other... anyway, this got very toxic very quickly. But anyway, on to happier things, from toxic to tap dancing. You're taking your first lesson this week. I'm so excited for you.
Why? Why do you always have to tell the listeners, like, all my activities?
Because, I don't know, because I find it deeply interesting, and I'm assuming the audience does too. So... have you bought the shoes at least?
No. You can do the trial without the... it's not the trial, like they're going to have you into the football team or something. But you can try the class without the shoes, because, I mean, it would be pointless to try... It would be pointless to, like, to buy the shoes if then imagine you don't like it.
Yes, very true.
Most dancing classes do this in Madrid, that you can just go to one and try it. See if you like it, then you can decide whether you sign up.
Yeah, so why tap dancing? What was it that you've done? Bollywood, you've done what else have you done?
No, that's it. Bollywood.
That's Bollywood. So now you're graduating to tap dance
in the world of dancing. Only
so
no, I don't know. Well, you know how much I like rhythm, and we have a podcast about rhythm, and we have an article about rhythm.
It's one of our best performing podcast episodes, actually.
And we have a blog entry about that too.
Actually, speaking about the competition, that rhythm is actually our best performing episode like this year for a long time. But then one of my one of my story ones, I think Conversation is a Gateway Drug, pulled slightly ahead of it recently, so it's slightly beating it in the numbers. Not that I'm noticing that or anything.
The passive aggressive.
So we jest, obviously. We don't have this much rancor in real life. It's all...
Only you.
It's all the show. Yeah, it's all... I'm just very bitter. But apart from that, we'll in part two, we're going to talk about nice things, such as harps and mythology and the symbolism between the people that play those harps. And we'll also... Well, we'll talk a lot about that, basically. But... you mentioned to me off air that you know you hated the IELTS exam. That's because you're studying it, but teaching it is very fun because it's very easy
it's
to teach.
Very fun.
Well, not very fun, but I find it really fun to teach exam classes because there's so little. I mean, you just need to know the structure of the exam and then just correct all the stuff that have to correct and obviously give feedback and everything. But there's such a rigid structure to it.
Makes you feel really nice that you know a lot of stuff and people don't.
That would be one thing, yeah. But then secondly, it's because like in other classes, you have to have a balance between learning and that they're kind of having a good time. But in exam classes, even
they must hate every minute.
No,
that makes you happy.
That's not it. No, I mean, obviously try and make it pleasurable that you do, but you know, there's less pressure. Just go in and just like, go. This is like a very rigid structure to the class as well. So in a way, I mean, we all love boundaries and structures.
That
so.
Makes you sound lazy.
No, because I'm very dynamic in my other classes.
Oh, okay. But so just, you make up for it with other people that are not those people.
Exactly, yeah.
Fair enough.
But no, the real reason is because I really enjoy the academic readings. But you have an academic story. Hey, come on, Dungeons and Dragons player to my right here. But anyway, but you, did you fail the IELTS or did you pass it?
I didn't. What's this? I didn't fail the IELTS at all. That's the reason why I could go and have my master's.
Oh, but you got caught with the sea urchin part of a reading.
Yeah, no. I just threw them volunteer information. Okay, no, it's just like you told me that the texts were really enlightening, and I told you that in my experience it was a bit annoying because I remember back way when I took the test, which was like 2006, right? So like, you know,
yeah,
a long time ago,
12 years ago.
I got a text, like a reading, and it was about sea urchins. Sea urchins and some other animal, I can't remember. But then I didn't know what sea urchin was and I didn't know what the other animal was because they're like very specific terms. It's not something that you can prepare for. And you couldn't infer it from the text, which is what we always tell students to do if they don't know the words.
In the context, of course, it's the get out of jail card for all teachers.
Yeah, but you honestly, you couldn't do that. So then it was really hard because I didn't know what they were.
Have you heard the word street urchin?
No.
Okay. Well, I can
explain. Is that from the Urban Dictionary?
No, it's not from the Urban Dictionary. No, it's like if you think of Charles Dickens and those kind of like boys that be on the street, like...
Okay.
Like little tramps.
Oh, yeah.
Tramps
in
training.
Yeah,
like homeless, you know? And they'd be kind of urchins.
Urchins.
Kind of like orphans, probably. Okay. Orphans and homeless or whatever. Mm-hmm. They'd be urchins. But again, you wouldn't really need that in
IELTS.
IELTS, exactly, for example. I just remember what you called your blog as well back in university. It's very nice.
But what's wrong with that? Like, you know, it was a blog about mud brick houses. What do you want me to call it?
So what do you call it?
Mud and Straw.
Mud
what's
and
wrong
straw.
With that?
It sounds like a metal band. That's what I like about it.
Well.
You know, like a dad rock band or something.
Maybe when I set my own tap dancing group, I can call it Mud and Straw.
Mud and Straw, the tap dancing experience. But no, the reason I like the IELTS reading is because you do learn lots of things. So for example, the topic today was cognitive dissonance. I think you know some of this already because you've seen the study featured in the article. But it talks about a journalist who he kind of infiltrates a doomsday cult and they think the world's going to end. And before it's supposed to end, they shy away from publicity and wait for the day of reckoning to come. But they wouldn't die, of course. They would be swept up into a UFO or a spaceship. Obviously, the world did not end. That's why we're still here talking. But what happened next surprised the journalist. I won't say paragraph B. but he, they basically were hungry for attention from the media and went to the press proclaiming that because of their faith, they had averted this doomsday scenario. And their job now on Earth was to spread the good word and to proselytize, basically. And that's why this cataclysmic event hadn't happened, while they're still alive, but they could still believe in their religion, their divine purpose, and didn't have to see the absence of the doomsday as evidence of their religion or cult being based on falsehoods, but they could kind of absorb this inconsistency into like a slightly altered narrative where they could still believe their core beliefs without having to let go of those commitments, you know. So it's a very interesting.
What level was this?
Well, it was academic IELTS, so it could be C. I think it's probably C1. No, this is actually slightly easier than other ones. So, but it's, with the other one, the other part of the reading that you're familiar with is the study that was conducted where people were told to lie to a group of people. Those who were paid $20 were like, hey, okay, we're lying, it's not great, but we're getting remunerated, we're getting paid for it, so that's cool. And in the group that were paid like $1,
like, what crap is this?
Well, no, the funny thing is they felt, well, I don't want to be like known as a liar, or I feel guilty telling lies to people. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to start believing the lie. Because
convince yourself.
Well, you convince yourself that yeah, so yeah. You're not like actively saying I'm going to start believing it now, but it kind of happens in the background of their mind where like, yeah, it's true what I'm saying, but that's the cognitive dissonance because you know deep down it's not true, but it can sound true. And you're like, if you commit to it hard enough, it can be true. So, you know, that can happen to people though.
Okay,
like,
yeah, but they're good people as well, though.
I've never met them. I don't know. I've just seen the synopsis of the study. But but I think that does happen to people where they're lying and they know they're lying, even like little things to their family or whatever. And they start believing it almost, you know, or they get offended if they're not believed, even though they know they're lying. It's just like, well, yeah, I am lying, but you don't know I'm lying. How can you get offended? But it kind of starts with a Charles Darwin quote about how it's not the strongest or the smartest that will necessarily survive through generations, but those who can react to the change. And that's what cognitive dissonance is. In a sense, it is the opposition to change, because instead of confronting and accepting that change, what you're doing is telling a story to accommodate that change into your narrative so you can feel comfortable and not perceive that change. But in reality, things are different and you're just not willing to accept it. So they kind of give the advice of just like, you know, accept change, because everything is always changing. Except this podcast released every Thursday, unless we can't edit it on time. It's released on a Friday. So that is kind of an interesting IELTS reading, I thought. You look very depressed by that.
Yeah, God, that's like deep stuff for students.
Well, the most difficult thing was helium. So like that was like also boring, but also complicated for the student to kind of grasp. But anyway, that's enough for part one, I think. So what we can do is just take a little musical break and return for part two. Yes, I am ready. So this is part two. This is staying in, even though you're editing it. So we're going to talk about harps specifically in this part of the show. Now, we do have a video on YouTube called Harps in TV Shows and Movies. It starts with Fraser Crane's father reminiscing and then a harp sound, which is a classic of TV when you're going back in time. But it turns out it's actually somebody in the house playing the harp, and that's a very... well, in a way, maybe obvious, but also a very funny joke. It goes in then to the Burmese Harp, which is a Japanese movie that you'll be telling us a little bit about as well. The Marx Brothers, they're in Casablanca. What's the name of the movie again? A Night in Casablanca. You'll be talking to us about that also. Also looks at a few other Asian movies. Kung Fu something.
Yeah. Hustle.
Kung Fu Hustle, that's the one. Yeah. There's a Cary Grant movie where he plays the harp also, and
the Bishop's Wife.
And then there is obviously Sense and Sensibility is also one of that. Pride and Prejudice, that's not in the video, but that's also a TV show, I think, that had a harp scene in it. Mm. I think I feel like I'm missing one as well.
No, I think that is all.
Yeah, so you, well, you'll hear more about our blog in part three of the show, Irish Slice of Madrid, but you have written an article about expanding on this video, discussing the deeper dimensions of harps and what they represent in culture. So wherever you want to start with this, You can start there and you can take it away.
That is the, well, you actually came up with the idea of putting together snippets of where the harp appeared in movies.
Mm-hmm.
And just, well, when I saw them, I was just interested in knowing what those movies were about, because I hadn't heard of some of them, and well, some of them turned to be not particularly interesting, like the Kung Fu Hustle one, for the purposes of culture, you know.
Of course, yeah.
It's more of a comedy. But then there was the Burmese harp, and there was the Marx Brothers one. It was just an example of something that featured in many other movies, which was harp.
What I like about this movie is that in other scenes, you enter a scene and someone's playing a harp, but in this scene, you really do see him picking it up, looking at it, touching it. And it's a more intimate scene with the instrument compared to the other one. So even though there are focal points of the plot and also convey emotion, it seems that Marx, is it Harpo, no? Harpo Marx, yeah. And his name comes from his love of harps as well.
That's it.
What you told me. You can really see his relationship with the harp is actually quite a deep one, as it was in real life. And then he plays it, and then he looks very ecstatic and happy when he's playing it as well. So that's kind of, there's an aside, I guess, from what you're talking about, but it is one of my favorite scenes, apart from the Burmese harp, in that sequence of clips that we've mentioned, because you really do see evidence of what you're going to go on and talk to us about in this part soon. No? I think it's a kind of a spiritual, almost transcendent experience of playing the harp.
Yes, the scene featuring the video for the Burmese harp is kind of like the main scene, is the what structures the whole story, which is the fact that, well, the movie is about Japanese soldiers who are in the Burma campaign in the Second World War. And basically this is at the end, right at the end of the war. And music is really important throughout. So just to talk about the different parties in the conflict, you know, there's a scene right at the beginning that is like really, well, can be very moving, where Japanese and British soldiers sing together, which can seem a bit bizarre, but if you look at the movie, you will see why that's significant. That's right at the beginning. But then this scene that we included, where he plays the harp, basically this person used to play the harp when he was still in this military unit with his other soldiers. And he taught himself, and then he used it to make people motivated, and to bring them together. However, after they lose the war, he just disappears. And then the rest of his unit one day finds this Buddhist monk who's playing a harp. And just from hearing what he's playing, they seem to be able to recognize him, in spite of the fact that he doesn't seem to be the same person, obviously, because he was a Japanese soldier, this is a Buddhist monk, and he's playing like a local instrument. It just inspires the same feelings and the same emotions as his colleague did. And really, that's the whole, the leitmotif of the whole movie, because it's basically about how he finds peace in that, and everybody else finds peace in music too, and it sort of like brings up like the absurdity of war in a way.
Okay, very interesting. I think it is amazing, because as you're describing these things and the kind of leitmotif of music in that particular movie, I was thinking about all the other movies that feature music in this way. There's a famous scene, perhaps not a famous scene in The Good and Bad, The Ugly, but it's one of my favorite scenes when a few of the prisoners in one part of the movie are being tortured, and they make the other prisoners play music to drown out the sorrow, to drown out the pain and the cries of the people, but also in a kind of perverse way, for, to make him do something celebratory at a time when a great excess was happening or abuse of power. And you can see the musicians playing this kind of mournful song and also crying because they know what's happening to their comrades at the hands of their prison guards. But also that there's a quiet dignity to it as well, where you have this idea of brotherhood and comradeship. And if you look at Casablanca as well, again, a lot of famous scenes in this beautiful movie, but there's a scene where the German Nazi soldiers are singing their anthem. And then the resistance fighter, who is now dating Rick's ex-girlfriend, you know, played by Humphrey Bogart, Rick, that is, not the love interest. And he comes in and they sing the French national anthem, and it becomes this focal point of their identity as they're stranded in this kind of you know, North African city. And even things like Gabriel's oboe in The Mission, again, we have this clash of two cultures. And then it's a long time since I've seen it, but I think who's the Jeremy Irons? He's in the forest or the jungle, I should say, playing the oboe, this kind of pipe instrument. And then the Indians who are kind of maybe tracking him kind of come almost disarmed by the music. And there's like just watching the performance as well. So it's an interesting idea that music that runs through movies, because in some ways it's just garlanding the scene in the background, or it's to express something very personal as well. It's very adaptable as a motif, but also as well in a lot of great movies, you have this idea of it bringing people together or emphasizing the division between people. So I think it's you know, not necessarily through the harp, but just through a variety of instruments. So it's a great way to enjoy movies as well, looking at it musically, not just through the soundtrack, but how it is very much part of the story as well. But sorry, I think I've distracted from the harp instrument as well. So apart from movies as well, there is a supranational. It's actually an appropriate goof because we're talking about community, but also a supernatural dimension to the harp, and also particularly with an Irish god as well called Dagda, who we've mentioned before when we were discussing Ireland, and also in reference to the seasons. And you're going to explain a little bit more about that as well, no?
Yes, well, he doesn't feature in movies, but...
not yet, at least, anyway.
No, well, I mean, he better not, because myths are something that is usually very badly portrayed in movies. I don't know if you can think of any good examples, but in general...
Well, I'll tell you what, Nick Cave, my great friend, he's good friends with Russell Crowe, or he knows him at least, and he was charged with writing the sequel to Gladiator, so Gladiator 2 basically, but he knew his movie would never be made, so he just like wrote it with gleeful abandon, as in like, I'll put whatever I want in this, it will never be made. And it starts off, I can't remember the story very well, but he starts off with Maximus in the other world. So it features Roman gods. He's to complete all these different tasks to get back into, I think, to get to heaven. I recommend reading the synopsis of this aborted Gladiator movie first, primarily because I don't remember, but also it's delightfully mad. But I don't get to see it. But I think it's really interesting because it is logical, because it's very obvious, or it's very easy for, you know, even the makers of Rome, that great TV show by the BBC, or The Gladiator, for example, where you have a reference to religion, but, you know, what if we just assume that their religion is actually real in their world, and then you can take it into that point as well. And Nick Cave is a very skilled and very educated writer, also in the realm of religion. I mean, primarily Christianity. I don't think most, like, modern people are well-versed in ancient Roman mythology, you know, in terms of, like, you know, intimately, you know, unless you're like an academic or whatever. But I think you would have made quite a compelling story, to be honest with you. But anyway, so you're right. So, but the majority of cases, mythology is not done very well in these things. Yeah. But Dagda, the Irish god, movie coming soon, hopefully. But his relationship with harp is quite a fascinating one, and has a very widespread as well.
So the idea behind Dagda's harp is that he's able to control people's emotions through playing it. So he used that specifically to defeat the Fomorians, who were the enemies basically of the first inhabitants of Ireland, according to legend. And basically he played what was called a four angled music, which meant that well, it's got actually specific names in Irish for, you know, making people cry, making people laugh uncontrollably, and also making them fall asleep and dream. So by using like this sequence, making them cry, then laugh, then make them fall asleep, he managed to defeat them. And also his harp was magic. So it's just like magical. So he left it somewhere, and then it got stolen by these Fomorians, and it just magically go back to him, flying, and in the process of flying back, killed a few people. Then he finished all the others off by playing these four types of music that mixed all these emotions. But really, it's just a nice metaphor in a way, because, well, this is like, you know, like music is magical, you know, but in a metaphorical sense. But it is, you don't even need to resort to that, because that's what music does, you know, stir emotions. So whether it makes us happy or sad, or, you know, makes us relaxed, then that's what music is. And probably one of the people that know this best are the Irish, because they have a long standing tradition of using music as a cultural form of expression.
Also as well, it's a marker of the seasons and of time. What did you discover about these aspects of the harp and Dagda?
Well, he, as well as like using music to stir emotions, he uses the harp to, it says, put an order to seasons. And, well, it's interesting because like seasons are a measure of time, but also depending on our emotions, like they can also, our emotions can also make time feel shorter or longer, or if we're very happy, it goes very fast. If not, it goes very slowly. So it's not a far-fetched connection. You know, the fact that the harp can control people's emotions and also control like the way in which people divide time. So both things are related.
Yeah, it's true. I mean, you mentioned Vivaldi's Four Seasons as well. So when it goes through the course of the year in those four seasons, the rhythm and the music changes to kind of convey what we traditionally associate with the different parts of the year, you know? So I guess as well, if he's calling time with the seasons, the rhythm and the way he plays his harp would have probably changed to signify a passing of a certain watershed or moment in time, you know? So it's now spring, now it's summer, now it's autumn, now it's winter. And if you could hear his harp, it would... you would know by listening to it what time of the year you're in, no?
Probably, because there's always, well, traditionally, I don't know, autumn is always associated more with melancholy, and spring is like a happier and more, well, it's all related to nature, no? Like with leaves falling and leaving like sunny times behind, and then when it gets to spring, everything sort of like comes back to life. So,
yeah, I wonder as well if it took on a wider cultural or divine significance, because maybe at ancient Celtic feasts and parties, the music they played probably reflected the festivities they were having at different times of the year, which in turn they're having those festivities to mark those different times of the year. So probably the people going to those things were hearing different music at different times of the year, and then that became attributed to this god, divine figure like Dagda, where his harp had all these magical qualities, and also like the real life musicians, his songs called the season by changing the tune at least four times in the year, you know. I don't know, it's all speculation, but
well, I think it's, I mean, like we've spoken about before about how like Irish time was like traditionally marked by the harvest, and that's still like you can still see that in the names of the months even. So I think actually music has defined more like the transitional periods, because for example, when we look at like the measure of time, for example, in Irish culture, it's not so much about like what happens in the main season, but more about what happens in between seasons. And in the case of like, it's the same, like I feel with autumn and spring, because they're always, I don't know, there's a lot more like magic and mystery built around it, to the point that, you know, we were able like just a minute ago to ascribe an emotion to autumn or to spring. But then if you asked, you know, what the emotion is for winter, then perhaps it wouldn't be so clear. So I think it's like those transitional moments that really define what the rest of the time is.
I think it's also nice and fitting because we started off talking about in part two about the universality of the music and what it can mean to like this supernational brotherhood and whatever. But modern musicians, when they do approach these ideas, one of our favorite songs is the Winter Song, you might remember. So, you know, musicians still use this basic dynamic or formula of like the Winter Song or the Summer Song, the Spring Song, the Autumn Song, or their titles will obviously be different, but and they will maintain the energy of a, like centuries old ideas, no, really, in approaching these seasons as well. So I don't know, it's a very broad subject anyway, you can get lost down a rabbit hole of all this, but thank you very much for enlightening us about Dagda and all the things related to the harp.
Very welcome.
In broader culture and our also Irish mythology as well. So we'll be talking to you very briefly very soon in part three. Welcome back to part three, the part definitely not recorded after part one. So thank you for sticking with us thus far in the show. So we should plug our blog. We're always plugging things in part three, but we have never plugged the blog before. It's now officially live. If you don't like how it looks, don't kill us. We're using a free plan in WordPress because WordPress can be expensive, but I think it looks kind of nifty. Has all the elements there that make for a good read. It's called the Irish Slice of Madrid. And it's basically a history of Irish people in the Spanish capital. I was just kind of turning to see what I said on the website, even though I wrote it. So currently there are three articles up, but we have plans to expand it greatly. So speaking of shout outs, obviously people don't know who Eamon is, but Eamon is a guy who used to live here in Madrid. Now he's back in Cork.
Shout out to Eamon.
And he's a good boy, but I told him about the blog and he gave us loads of ideas. A lot of them we already knew ourselves anyway. So stretching from the obvious, well, not the obvious, but the footballing ones, which are a bit more superficial, but also interesting. You've Ian Hart, who spent a year at Levante in League One. And more significantly, John Aldridge, the Irish striker, who was like in 1994. One of my earliest memories of him was in USA 94 when we were losing to Mexico. And the Ford official was being a bit of a clown and wouldn't let him come on as a substitute. And John Aldridge started like swearing up a storm. And so did Jack Charlton, our coach, as well. And Jack Charlton got sent off, I think, in that match. But John Aldridge eventually managed to get in the field and he scored a goal. We lost 2-1 because it was USA 94. I think the game was at like 12 o'clock or 3 o'clock in the afternoon. Steve Staunton, who was like pale and blonde, was red. after the first minute, need a water every 5 seconds. So, you know, the conditions for footballers wasn't really considered in 1994. So we crashed out in that last 16 round, but that was one of my earliest memories. But his contribution also was to be the first foreign player to play for Real Sociedad. So like the Bilbao have a Basque-only policy for their players. So you have to be a Basque, basically, to play. Sociedad had that in effect until I think it was the... It must be the 80s or maybe it was the 90s. Well, we're going to research this obviously more and we'll get that confirmed. But he went for them and I think he won a league title as well with them. So like a lot of resistance to him coming originally because this was a great break with tradition. But he remembers his time in the Basque country very fondly and also how all the Spanish players or the Basque players rather were teaching him like all the swear words in Basque. But yeah, it ended up a nice story because, you know, it was a new direction for the club. As I said, I think he won a league there. And it's kind of a little bit of history for a lot of reasons, because also Sociedad, if they did win the league, a lot of qualifications here, like it's not very often these small teams do win it because it's usually the duopoly of Barca and Madrid, even though both are conspiring to lose as many games as possible this season. So who knows if Sevilla or Atletico or another team clinch the title. But it's enough football. I can see you switching off.
Hashtag not a football podcast.
Not a football podcast. But other things that you mentioned, like Irish people with Spanish names, Evan de Valera, Irish president and prime minister for a long time as well. One of our leaders in 1916 and also took power in 1932. So he was in the opposition party and then they took power in 1932. People brought guns to the parliament, to the Dáil Éireann, because they thought there could be trouble because the party that had won the Civil War were in power until 1932. But then the opposition, who were the anti-treaty side, got power. But what happened was a successful transition of power and the strength of the democracy was shown. But he was also, his father was Cuban, but also from Extremadura is what people say. And Winston Churchill called him the Spanish onion in the Irish stew, which I'm not sure what that means. But he did also say about him that trying to negotiate with him was like trying to pick up mercury with a fork. And the witty retort from De Valera was like, why doesn't he try a spoon, because he was very wary of like negotiating against the De Valera because he's a very wily, savvy politician. But things like the Battle of Kinsale, the Flight of the Earls, subsequently as well, O'Donnell, Cayo O'Donnell is a street after Irish people as well. The Spanish flu, Irish, I think I might mention that already, Irish people who've been killed by the Spanish flu. And also other leaders that like fought Oliver Cromwell in England, in Ireland actually, at different sieges. Some of those sieges were won. I think another siege where they were defeated by Cromwell's forces as well. So down through the generations, basically, you have a lot of history that we're going to explore in more depth in that blog, for example. I can see you rolling your eyes though, so if you want to stop me in my tracks, feel free to say something about the blog or anything else.
No, I'm not.
Oh, yeah, the blog. What's it called? The blog called? I know I said it already, but you can reinforce it.
The Irish Slice.
It's the Irish Slice for short, but the actual title is Irish Slice of Madrid. So, like, when you're wanting to be cool and you're talking to your friends, it's like, oh, the Irish Slice, you know. But otherwise, Irish Slice could be like a cooking thing or something like that, you know. People looking for recipes. We don't have recipes.
The Irish Slice of Madrid.
Okay, perfect. So, okay, I'm tired now. So you plug the rest of our stuff.
No, just you can listen to the podcast on Radio Public.
Yeah.
If you do, you help us. Otherwise, you can listen on platform of your choice.
That is very true. Also, at ARPA One on Twitter, at ARPA Media. .com is our website. sorry, why is that handle again? LARPA is our Instagram account and also LARPA Media. You can find us on YouTube and also on Patreon. If you do want to support us, that would be fantastic. LARPA Media is how you can find us as well. So we will be back with more chit-chat in next week's podcast. We really hope you enjoyed this episode and we'll be back to ask Mary more about her tap dancing adventures as well. So I don't know, that's me. I'm tapped out. So good luck.
Bye.
The LARPA Podcast, the home for cultural chit-chat in and outside Madrid. People will talk.